So we're happy to welcome back Ari Nierenberger to speak about the indispensability and uniqueness of the Baha'i Revelation. Thank you, Ari.
Wow, this is quite a full house. Thank you all for coming. And I assume most of you are attracted by this really grandiose title. It's indispensability. It was difficult for me. I practiced that word a few times. And many of you I recognize as Baha'i friends for you, and some of you I don't recognize at all. And I hope that you are just curious to learn about the Baha'i faith. And so I will just speak in very general introductory terms. And we will have lots of time for questions. I'm going to speak a little bit though, the beginning. Actually, and I have made some notes too, because I will not just only have it all in my head. So I'm going to read this quote again that hopefully was the one that attracted you to come here. "The world's equilibrium hath been upset through the vibrating influence of this most great, this new world order. Mankind's ordered life hath been revolutionized through the agency of this unique, this wondrous system, the like of which mortal eyes have never witnessed." And a little later in the same paragraph, Baha'u'llah says, "This is the changeless faith of God, eternal in the past, eternal in the future." Now this can read or sound like a contradiction of sorts. And well, I have over the years discovered there are a variety of, so to speak, contradictions in the Baha'i scriptures, in the Baha'i teachings, that become clearer to me as I deepen over the years in what the meaning could be. And we're all encouraged to investigate the truth for ourselves, you know, use our own minds. It's a very important gift we're given by God, and we're definitely encouraged in the Baha'i writings to use that to understand our life and to understand the writings, and to apply the scientific method of understanding, which, talking about unique, and I'm trying to figure out a few points here and there, what makes this revelation unique? And the emphasis on scientific understanding, I would say, is a unique message amongst the various religions in the world, and especially in this day and age. The established religions, who have all contributed a great deal to the advancements of various civilizations in history, have, for the most part, split off into a variety of groups, subgroups, sects, sectarian groups, different denominations. And within that, you'll find some that very much are promoting scientific thinking, scientific investigation, and some are very much into holding on to very literal scriptural interpretation of their various religion, and which will turn into fundamentalism very easily, and then sometimes be used in violent ways to enforce something that doesn't seem very rational anymore for this day and age. Now, one of the unique features of the Baha'i Faith is that, yes, it encourages critical thinking, and it provides scripture to guide us. And so this is the changeless faith of God, eternal in the past, eternal in the future. In this way, it is related to all the religions. And I might as well bring it out right now. The big theme of the Baha'i writings is unity. That is one of the really, I would say, the distinguishing feature the emphasis that's put on unity in the Baha'i writings and the role that this unity theme, this call to unity, will play in creating a new world order. And as one aspect of that is that the Baha'i Faith, who is now 164 years old as we measure it, or maybe it's 165, I don't quite know. It's officially started on May 23rd, 1844. But it starts in May, and so the Baha'i calendar goes from March 21st. And I need to admit, I didn't look it up where we are right now. You can do the maths. But since then, the Baha'i Faith actually has not... Good evening. Welcome. Find your seat probably over there. Hello. Hi. Hey, there's some couple of chairs over here. Carol, there's a chair over there.
Okay.
Oh, you want to be close?
Trisha just called me. I'm afraid she might be lost or something. So
okay, you're going to watch out for her?
I'll step out.
Okay. So I was just marveling at the fact after 165 years the Baha'i Faith has not been split. There is no different Baha'i sects. There is one faith. Not that there hasn't been a tumultuous history and various dissensions over the time, but there is a strong lineage of succession that has been given through the various leaders of the Baha'i Faith throughout history, and you know, the center or the central theme of that is called the Covenant of Baha'u'llah. Now, I've probably mentioned that Baha'u'llah is the prophet founder of the Baha'i Faith, but if not, then I need to catch up with that here. But then again, one other unique feature of the Baha'i Faith is that we recognize actually two prophet founders of the faith. And when I say prophet founder, we recognize them as having a very unique station. In the Baha'i terminology, we call them manifestations of God. And Baha'u'llah, in his own words, fulfills the prophecies of all the scriptures of the religions, who promise that at the day of God, which I think is the Jewish terminology, there will be a great messenger coming, the Lord of hosts, the Prince of Peace, the return of Christ, the fifth Buddha. The Sunnis also waiting for the return of Christ or the return of Imam Hussein. Whatever expectation has been in the prophecies of the various religions, Baha'u'llah is fulfilling these prophecies. And that's a huge claim. And to some of us, that might be a bit scary. No, and I don't necessarily want to dwell onto that too much, but we live in an area where here, this bookstore is just a wonderful example of the amazing richness that is given us in terms of drawing on spiritual traditions of all kinds. It's amazingly rich. And Baha'u'llah says that he is the voice of God. He speaks with the voice of God for this day and age. He reveals what is the will of God for mankind for this day and age. And that is a unique feature of the Baha'i Faith. I will, now, because there is a little bit of confusion in terms of when you talk about the manifestation of God and how do we see that in relationship to God. The Baha'i teachings say that God is unknowable in his essence. Even using the his or her, it's a matter of speech. God is eternal, is incomprehensible to us in our minds. And so, as much as we know about God, is that from age to age, a completely pure soul is being manifested that is called, authorized, inspired to reveal to us God, the voice of God. And yet it's very made very clear in the Baha'i writings, and actually one of the successors of Baha'u'llah, the second one, is his great-grandson, Shoghi Effendi, who guided the faith from 1921 till 1957. And I read this, he makes it clear that while the manifestations reveal the names and attributes of God and are the means by which humanity has access to the knowledge of God and his revelation, Shoghi Effendi states that the manifestations should never be identified with that invisible reality, the essence of divinity itself. In relation to Baha'u'llah, the guardian is a title that was given by Shoghi Effendi, he was the guardian of the faith. In relation to Baha'u'llah, the guardian wrote that the human temple that hath been the vehicle of so overpowering a revelation is not to be identified with the reality of God. Concerning the uniqueness of Baha'u'llah's station and the greatness of his revelation, Shoghi Effendi affirms that the prophetic statements concerning the day of God found in the sacred scriptures of past dispensations are fulfilled by the advent of Baha'u'llah. Now, that sounds good and clear, and you know, I gladly admit that there is an aspect of mystery to that that I don't understand. I don't really understand God, and nor do I truly, fully understand the reality of the manifestation of God. I am touched, though, at some point, that makes me a Baha'i. At some point, I heard who Baha'u'llah is, and I accepted him. And a lot of the scriptures of the Baha'i faith are about the mystic relationship to God and how we are as individuals called to find our connection, and that's a big portion of it. But I'm not here tonight. We're going to have other speakers about mysticism, and the personal journey is very important in the Baha'i teachings, the personal journey of the individual soul towards his creator. But the uniqueness and the indispensability of the Baha'i revelation, which revelation is actually bringing some knowledge, which is in this case also the given knowledge that God sends down, something important to know, is concerning the life of humanity as a whole and how we are going to steer from where we are right now into a world society, which is one of the promises of Baha'u'llah. That's one of his stated missions, if not the stated mission. It is one of the quotes, and I won't necessarily... The fundamental purpose animating the faith of God and his religion is to safeguard the interests and promote the unity of the human race and to foster the spirit of love and fellowship amongst men. And that sounds like not that unique when you look at what other religions talk about. And yet, the extent of unity and the extent of the system that Baha'u'llah talks about and the Baha'i revelation talks about is that we are forming a global society. Now, globalization nowadays is a term that isn't always considered just in a positive light. It's people are arguing about, and there's abuses in the economic realm about in this name of globalization, and those are all birth pangs. But I believe, and the Baha'is believe in this process that there's not going to be a turning back. We are in the process of forming a global society. And the question is, what is going to guide us to come together on a unified set of principles? Like every great civilization had a unified set of principles. You know, and mostly, if, you know, honestly, you look in the history of the world, it has been associated with one of the major religions of the world. Civilizations have been built on religious principles. And the mission of the Baha'i Faith is that we will build a world society, a global society, and that Baha'u'llah provides the blueprint for that. But a while back I said one of the unique features of the Baha'i revelation is that we actually have two manifestations of God, two messengers, two prophets. And that's a unique occurrence in history. There was a personage called the Bab, which means the gate, and he was the one who actually proclaimed himself on May 23rd, 1844, in Persia, and he proclaimed himself to be the Qa'im, which is what the Shiites had been waiting for. And he started a new religion, and in very quick succession over a few years, he had a tremendous following all over Persia. And the religious and secular authorities, meaning the Shah and various mullah hierarchies, I don't quite understand, I remember them, opposed him very severely. And in the end, after 6 years, in 1850, on July 9th, which is yesterday, he was executed by firing squad. And his central theme, the greatest theme of his writings, was that he announced the coming of the great prophet, of a great messenger of God, in short succession. But at the same time, so sometimes he's compared to John the Baptist, who announced Christ. With the distinction, though, so there's that parallel, but then as Baha'is, we also recognize him as an independent manifestation of God. He had the Christ spirit himself. So the Baha'is revere him that way, and the Baha'i World Center nowadays is in Haifa, Israel, and the Baha'is have built very beautiful terraces. And I just read recently that the Baha'i World Center in Haifa, and also the shrine in Akka, which is outside, well, Akka is across the bay and outside of Akka, have been added to the United Nations World Heritage Sites. So that's quite something for something relatively new. And at the center of this, this is a whole sweep of gardens that goes up from the bottom of Mount Carmel up to the very top, and it's terraced, and 19 terraces in the middle is what they call the Golden Jewel. It's the Shrine of the Bab. So, and his remains were, it's a very interesting story how his remains actually got to go interred there, but I'll tweak your curiosity for the sequel. Can get there another time. We want to go there today. So in terms of what that means, because revelation is, well, the way, and all I'm saying here is just my understanding of it, and you know, we will have some time for questions and answers. There are some wonderful books too where you might read some slightly different interpretations of this. I always like one of the quotes that's attributed, I think it's Baha'u'llah. It talks about that every word has 72 meanings, mm-hmm. and then every meaning of that can have 72 meanings again. So you can go on and on and on in terms of fine-tuning meanings and potentially getting yourself into quite a dialogue in the best case, or into a debate in the not so good case, which in the Baha'i writings actually is categorically or very strongly discouraged. That we are free to investigate the truth on the one hand, but then at the same time we also shall acknowledge that our understanding can only be our understanding, and to get into an argument with another person about a difference of understanding is futile at the best. It is actually contradictory to the principle of unity, which I've probably mentioned once. It's really the overriding principle of the Baha'i Faith. anything that contributes to the unity of mankind is good. Anything that contributes to dissension is to be avoided. Included in that, one of the rules in the Baha'i Faith is that backbiting is very strongly forbidden. Backbiting meaning that you talk badly about another person behind their back. It's a practice that's just basically discouraged in the political discourse in this country, where people are at freedom telling lies about each other and the media distributing them. So the Baha'is have within their system an electoral system that actually bypasses electioneering. And one reason for that is that it is very hard to campaign for somebody without getting potentially into saying something not so good about him. And that is not in the spirit of the Baha'i teachings. There are other reasons for that too. And again, that's for the next chapter also. But it is one unique feature of the faith that actually Baha'u'llah has provided the basic structure for his world order. So in previous dispensations, and I'm not a religious historian, and somebody here might be able to speak more eloquently to that, but as I remember, I mean, Christ has sort of, there's something about Peter being the rock, but then after that there have already been splits in the early Christianity and who's the leader. And in Islam, when Muhammad died, there was immediately discussion about who was the successor, and it actually blew up into a full-fledged war that stretched over. It's still going on, actually. It's flaring up these days between the Sunnis and the Shiites. And I don't know about the succession in Buddhism or in some of the other, in Judaism either. But the reality that we are here 165 years after Baha'u'llah's, no, after the Bab proclaimed the faith, we have one Baha'i faith, and we have institutions that go back to the inspiration of Baha'u'llah. He set the framework, he appointed his successor, and I haven't mentioned that yet. So the succession of the four central figures of the faith was, there was the Bab. He proclaimed that somebody great would be coming, a great messenger, which was Baha'u'llah, who proclaimed himself in 1863, 19 years after the Bab's declaration. And the number 19 is actually a very significant number in the Baha'i writings. You find it in several other situations. And Baha'u'llah's ministry, he passed away in 1892. And he left his Book of the Covenants, and the Tablet of the Covenant, and he appointed his son, his eldest son, who has later been known as Abdul Baha, which means the servant of God, servant of glory, as his successor. And there were a few people who were arguing with that, but in the overall, people accepted him, and he has a very unique station in the history of religion. Some people have, by meeting him, confused him with Christ himself. And I probably have something about this, that because it's a very, very unique aspect in the religious history. Yeah. At the foundation of this guidance lies the unique role which Baha'u'llah's writing confer on his eldest son, Abdul Baha. This unique figure is at once the exemplar of the pattern of life taught by his father, so the exemplar, he really exemplified the perfect Baha'i, the divinely inspired, authoritative interpreter of his teachings, and the center and pivot of the covenant which the author of the Baha'i Revelation made with all who recognize him. So he is the divinely inspired authoritative interpreter, which means not only has Baha'u'llah written about 100 volumes of text, which only a small portion of it has been translated from either Arabic or Persian into English, and from English into many, many languages all across the planet. But many of them are still waiting. They're sitting in the archives in Haifa. And his writings, which is another unique feature of the faith, in terms of religious history, his writings are authentic in the sense that he either penned them himself, or in most cases he dictated them to his, that's another difficult word, they call him emuniensis, I guess it's a secretary, a scribe, a person who would very quickly write down what Baha'u'llah, hello. There's a chair back in the right corner there.
And I'll get another one.
Let's see, go and get another chair.
There's plenty back there.
Yeah, I should really go back there, okay. So that he dictated his... a whole book would flow out of him within a day or two or three, and his scribe would just have, these were the days when people wrote with reed pens and you had to dunk them in ink and like write the stuff down like crazy, and sometimes they had a hard time reading it themselves. So I've read somewhere that then they would go and they would transcribe the stuff. The holy writings. they would transcribe it, write it all down in a legible way, and then they would go in front of Baha'u'llah, and not that they would read it to him, and he would say, but he would re-reveal, he would re-say what had been written, or what he had revealed before, to give them an opportunity to correct themselves. Yeah. Whatever accounts I've read about the atmosphere and the manner in which Baha'u'llah revealed his writings has touched me very deeply. So, like, there isn't a lot of emphasis on miracles in the Baha'i writings. It's not like Baha'u'llah this or healing. I mean, like in the Christianity, there's a lot more emphasis on Christ who performed miraculous works. There are a few interesting stories in the Baha'i history. There are a few miracles. One miracle, so to speak, is actually the execution of the Bab, just to tweak your curiosity a little bit more. But Baha'u'llah himself, the revelation, his way of revealing his writings is definitely something that is very convincing. So he has revealed over 100 volumes of authentic works. And then Abdu'l-Bahá, as his appointed interpreter, has written, I actually don't know how many, but he has written quite a lot of books himself. As a young child, he already wrote treatises. Actually, one book that's out, I think it's called The Secret of Divine Civilization, he wrote as a very young man, and his father told him to write it at a day, and it was really written sort of as a treatise, anonymously. He didn't pronounce who wrote it, but there was a big discussion going on in Persia in those days amongst some clergy and politicians about whether Persia should open up to the West and adopt the ways of the West. Because, so, this discussion is still going on amongst some of them. And so, this is a very interesting treatise that brings up the point of, yes, be open-minded, use that which is helpful, everything is given by God, no, and at the same time don't adopt the ways of the West that don't serve you, no. be proud of what you have in your heritage, be proud of what you can, and practice tolerance and true relationship with God. So this is not what this talk is really about. Get sidetracked. So the Abdu'l-Bahá fits in the category of unique aspects of this revelation, because he is he's almost a Christ-like figure, and yet he emphasized repeatedly that he was not a manifestation of God. And so to me, again, that's an aspect where I either say yes, I don't really understand. He was divinely inspired. He and yet he derived all his inspiration, he said, directly from Baha'u'llah, from his father. Sometimes I've sort of thought about, since I was brought up in Christianity, and this idea about the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, it seems so wonderfully manifested in reality, having the Father and the Son. And the Holy Spirit is really, actually, that's a whole other thing. Baha'u'llah somewhere says that the Holy Spirit has been generated through a single letter revealed by this most great spirit. So whatever that means, there are aspects of the spiritual realities that I don't understand. I'm not an expert, but the point is, we are all called to deepen, to understand, to try and understand. And in the process of immersing ourselves in the ocean of Baha'u'llah's writings, we are inspired to work together, to contribute to this new world order. So after Abdu'l-Bahá, who ministered from 1892 till 1921, who also came to America, he lived his life as his father. His father was persecuted all his life and spent 40 years in prison. No, that's not quite right, excuse me, but many, many years in prison. The last years of his life in Akka, which was the prison city of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, Abdu'l-Bahá accounts that he lived 40 years in prison by the time he was released by the Young Turks Revolution in 1812 or 11, not long before the First World War. And the first thing he did then in his 60s was travel to Europe and travel to America. And there are amazing accounts of his visits. He spent, I think, 10 months traveling through America and speaking, giving hundreds of talks at churches and synagogues and clubs of various kinds. So the Baha'i Faith isn't just a new kind of a thing in terms of just, you know, it's been around for a while, and yet it is brand new when it comes to religious history. And I'm jumping around a lot, so bear with me. I will open up in a little while for questions here. So when Abdu'l-Bahá passed away, and I already said that, he left the will of testament also in 1921, and he appointed his grandson, Shoghi Effendi, to be the guardian of the faith. And that came quite as a shock to Shoghi Effendi, and he adjusted to that because he was very young then. I think he was in his 20s. And he passed away in 1957. It's barely 60 years old. He worked very hard, tirelessly, to promote the faith. And he was very instrumental in really manifesting and translating what we call the administrative order of the Baha'i worlds into action, and he worked very diligently at spreading the Baha'i faith across the globe, so that I understand by now the Baha'i faith is recognized as the second widest spread religion on the planet, meaning localities where you have Baha'is and you have Baha'i groups that are organized into official assemblies. And yet, I think there's only about 6 million Baha'is on the planet by now. No, but it started with one person proclaiming himself as the messenger of God. So 165 years for 6 million, so how long? I'll let somebody do the math. How long it will be. Now, I don't know whether everybody ever will become a Baha'i, because what's important in the Baha'i teachings is really the unity. And Abdu'l-Bahá talks about unity, and he, you know, talks about candles of unity. And the cornerstone of these seven candles that he mentions is unity in religion. And we are very strongly encouraged as Baha'is to associate with the followers of all religions in a spirit of fellowship. So, yes, we do want the Baha'i faith to be known, and we want people to join Baha'u'llah, join the Baha'is, but at least we invite people to investigate, because it's an amazing claim, it's an amazing story, and it's an amazing promise in this day and age when the world seems to be teetering at the the edge of destruction at times. Brink, that was it. Thank you. I knew there was some ink in that word. That the Baha'i message is very positive. That it says, yes, this will happen. Mankind will come together. Mankind will go through a lot of heat and turmoil in the molding process, in the welding process. But the final outcome is very glorious, and that's really included in this idea about and where it started out, this wondrous system, the like of which mortal eyes have never witnessed. It is hard for us to understand, and Shoghi Effendi talks about this too. It is really, really impossible for us to understand, as children of the half-light, I've heard us called, how this life might be on this, will be on this planet, when we have abolished warfare as a way of international relations, and when we have inculcated some of the social principles that Baha'u'llah has given us. Social principles which many enlightened people will take for granted, like the equality of men and women, or the elimination of racism, or the elimination of the extremes of poverty and wealth, or universal education, or that science and religion need to agree. All these principles will be used in this new society to create a life that is going to be at once harmonious and diversified. This term unity in diversity is a Baha'i term. It's great, you know. It's like, I don't know whether it's been out somewhere else in the world, but it's an amazing concept. You know, to realize that we are going to find a way to be united in a very large sense without giving up. And that's not because there have been some secular attempts at creating, I'm thinking about communism or fascism in Germany, which often have the taste of you give up your individuality completely, not to serve something. And in the Baha'i writings, that's not the case. There is great emphasis on, and that's within everybody's personal journey, sacrifice and selflessness. And many of the books that you'll find here, whether they're from the Buddhist tradition or Eckhart Tolle, will teach you about the trappings of the ego and how we have to struggle to overcome that and to become one, to experience the oneness with mankind, with our world, with our life, with our creator. But Baha'u'llah puts this into a framework that is specifically setting structures for this society, how we're going to go about it, this global society. Yeah, let me see. So, unity, the unity of God, I probably made that clear by now, that the Baha'is believe that there's only one God. So that's one of the unity principles. Unity of religion means that all the religions that we've had in the past are like chapters in the one large book of religion. And currently the Baha'i faith is writing the next chapter. We're not claiming to be the last chapter ever, but in any means there will be other chapters written behind it. But it's a big chapter, it's a very important chapter. It's been talked about for thousands of years before, and it will be talked about thousands of years afterwards, because the unification of mankind on this planet to create a world society, while we can't imagine it, it's going to be after that we might go to out of space and really create different civilizations here, but we'll have enough to do. How this will be to create a world society, it's going to be amazing. And then the third principle of unity, which mentioned the writings, is the unity of humanity, unity of mankind, which nowadays you'll say, yeah, but when this was proclaimed in the 19th century, people were still arguing whether blacks or whites are really the same genetic race, or whether women and men are actually really on the same level as spiritual beings. And so this is very categorically explained and affirmed in the Baha'i writings that man and woman, all of us, ever race, we're all the same. And science has now proven that. Science has proven that there's no distinction genetically between any of the peoples on this planet. The other aspects of unity that I briefly mentioned, that Abdu'l-Bahá talks about, and there's probably lots of discussion to be had, because I, honestly speaking, when I read them, I don't totally understand them, how they distinguish themselves. He talks about unity in the political realm. He talks about unity of thought in world undertakings now. But then he talks about unity in freedom, unity of nations, unity of races, and unity of languages. And I'm just sort of going to rattle them off here, because, honestly speaking, I have a little hard time. Unity of nations, okay, I think about the United Nations, but unity in the political realm, how does that really differ? Or unity of thought in world undertakings. Now, there we find some things where, you know, mostly non-governmental organizations related to the United Nations that work together on resolving issues, you know, whether that's in the scientific field or in the humanitarian field. Unity in freedom, it's something to be, well, one idea to me, it's like it's going to be nice to have everybody free. The Baha'i Society doesn't envision a lot of prisoners. The Baha'i Society envisions a spiritual education of every human being to such an extent that the person will consider committing the crime as the severest punishment in itself. Unity of races is interesting too. It probably means, like, while we are cherishing diversity, it also means that people will intermarry a lot more, and we will create, really, in a very material way, a mixture of races that is going to be very unique, has never been here before. And unity of language, which is, that's basically the request that there will be one auxiliary language that will be taught to everybody on the planet, so that wherever you travel, you'll at least have one way to communicate. And since Baha'u'llah been around, attempts have been made at that. There was Esperanto, somebody invented that, and that has obviously not been the answer. But we have sort of English right now, but it's questionable whether that's going to survive as the... And any speculation about what the future universal language might be, we can go there another time too. So, I've talked a lot about the unity, and mixed in there is really the idea that, people might ask, why religion? And, you know, as we're talking about the indispensability of the Baha'i faith, the Baha'i revelation, is the recognition that religion has always been the greatest means for securing the peace and well-being of the peoples of the world. And so in that sense, it is proclaimed that it's not going to be some secular system. It is not going to be some ism out there. But that the religious impulse, the impulse of people to want to have a spiritual connection, and for people to want to connect to God and find the way to the manifestation, is an ancient desire that's uniquely human. That's one of the things that makes us human. And that your religion in that sense is necessary. It's necessary for our individual growth, and it's necessary for, in the specific stage, like always in the past, to create a civilization, a unified civilization. I will read a couple of prayers to close my talking, and then we can open up for questions. This prayer is by Baha'u'llah. O my God, O my God, unite the hearts of thy servants and reveal to them thy great purpose. May they follow thy commandments and abide in thy law. Help them, O God, in their endeavor, and grant them strength to serve thee. O God, leave them not to themselves, but guide their steps by the light of thy knowledge, and cheer their hearts by thy love. Verily, thou art their helper and their Lord. And this is also about unity, about, and this has been given to us by Abdul Baha. O my God, O my God, verily, I invoke thee and supplicate before thy threshold, asking thee that all thy mercies may descend upon these souls. Specialize them for thy favor and thy truth. O Lord, unite and bind together the hearts. Join in accord all the souls, and exhilarate the spirits through the signs of thy sanctity and oneness. O Lord, make these faces radiant through the light of thy oneness. Strengthen the loins of thy servants in the service of thy kingdom. O Lord, thou possessor of infinite mercy, O Lord of forgiveness and pardon, forgive our sins, pardon our shortcomings, and cause us to turn to the kingdom of thy clemency, invoking the kingdom of might and power, humble at thy shrine and submissive before the glory of thine evidences. O Lord God, make us as waves of the sea, as flowers of the garden, united, agreed through the bounties of thy love. O Lord, dilate the breasts through the signs of thy oneness, and make all mankind as stars, shining from the same height of glory, as perfect fruits growing upon thy tree of life. Verily, thou art the Almighty, the self-subsistent, the giver, the forgiving, the pardoner, the omniscient, the one creator. So this is the time anyone has any questions. I try and answer them. There's other people in the room who probably can answer questions also. Yes, hello.
Yeah, as a Baha'i, in just an ordinary day, what do you do differently as a Baha'i, both externally and internally?
Internally, I try and form my life to the prescriptions of Baha'u'llah. So he has given us guidelines, how to live life. And most of them are really not necessarily extremely different from the spiritual guidelines of other religions. As mentioned, one, I will, for instance, guard myself from backbiting, specifically. I have certain things that I do or don't do. What I do as a Baha'i is I'm encouraged every day to read sacred writings as nourishment, to read them in the morning and the evening. I at least once a day say a prayer, an obligatory prayer. So, similar to what you would call in Islam, where they have five times a day. In the Baha'i writings, we're actually given the option of three different, what they call obligatory prayers. One is very short, and one is not quite so short, and that one is to be said 3 times a day, and then one is quite long, and that one can be said once a day. And then we participate in a community life if we have enough Baha'is around, where the Baha'is have a calendar. We celebrate, there's a Baha'i calendar which is 19 months of 19 days, and at the beginning of every month we have a gathering called the feast, where the community gets together and have a devotional portion. We read scriptures and we have a community portion. And then there are some observances that happen over the course of the year. There's a Baha'i fasting month, so 19 days of the last month of the year, which is the new year is on March 21st with the spring equinox, and the 19 days before that are called the month of fasting, and not just called like that. It's actually, we fast as Baha'is, and the fast is similar to Ramadan in the sense that we don't eat and drink from sunrise to sunset. And then we are encouraged, if we can, to go on pilgrimage, which is, the pilgrimage is going to the shrines, as I mentioned, there in Acre, I mean outside of Acre and Haifa. And so in that sense, you live a life that is really not, I want to say it's not unique. It is unique in a certain way, and it's yet it is a spiritual life. It's a good life. It's not. Many people, I can say, you can be full of Baha'i spirit, coming out of a different tradition in that sense. And there's many great, people who have very spiritual ways in many other traditions. I'm not saying that is uniquely Baha'i. I don't experience it that way. Now, some of the prescriptions specifically, there are some that are specifically Baha'i. Like, for instance, like in some traditions, you'll have it's not permitted to listen to music in some Islamic traditions. And so in the Baha'i writings, that's not the case anymore. You're allowed to listen to music. You're encouraged to listen to music that's uplifting to the soul. There are some traditions where you're not allowed to eat red meat, or you have a kosher diet. And so in the Baha'i writings, they don't have that. But then in the Baha'i writings, you are asked to not drink alcohol and not use drugs unless ordered by a doctor. So there are specific prescriptions, specific what you would call personal law. No, versus there's a distinction between personal law, which you are responsible for yourself in relationship to God, and then an interdiction like backbiting. I mentioned that because it always struck me that it is in Baha'u'llah's book of laws, which is called the Kitab Yaqdas, he mentions backbiting in the same sentence like he mentions murder. So, and that would be more of a social application. It's very important in terms of how we're going to do it. Is personal too. It will shade your soul if you engage a lot of bad talking.
Do you have something like the Ten Commandments or the Five Precepts, or most religions they will go down? You mentioned a few of them, like not drinking and taking drugs, and
it's not
praying
quite as succinct as the Ten Commandments. Baha'u'llah's Book of Laws, the Kitab Yaqdas, is also called the Most Great Book. It has quite a lot of pages in there. Some of them are very practical and relate to how often you shall bathe. And some of them are very spiritual. And so this is a very unique book. But it is not, it includes everything that you will know from the Ten Commandments, in a sense. I mean, don't take me literal on this. I don't know. Yes, we are encouraged to honor our parents. No, and you're not. I don't remember my Ten Commandments all the way down. No, to say okay, this can be found.
But murder, stealing.
Yeah, you don't steal.
Lying.
You don't murder. You don't lie.
Yeah.
the whole issue of personal conduct in relationship to sexual relations mm-hmm. is, you might say from a little perspective, the Baha'is are conservative. They say they encourage marriage, and they say that you reserve sexual relations for marriage. So in that way, adultery would also be included in you don't do that. But then it just it goes a little bit beyond that. So it's not just a whole, it's not just these ten.
And they don't have a celibate priesthood or a celibate monks or nuns and all that.
No, as a matter of fact, there is no priesthood in the Baha'i faith, which was probably one of the reasons why there was a lot of opposition from the establishment of priesthood, because it basically means joblessness if you accept this religion, you know. And but beyond that, actually, Baha'u'llah says that we are not allowed to go into the monasteries. We're encouraged. So the division between the spiritual life and the mundane life is not existing in the Baha'i writings anymore. And one of the rules in his book is like that work performed in the spirit of service is worship. So that would be one of the guidelines of Baha'u'llah's law also. And so that we all shall really contribute to an ever advancing civilization, that we shall be concerned about the world we live in, that we shall not go in reclusion to live the spiritual life, but that spiritual life and the life here on the planet are one and the same, because we want to create a spiritual society. Called to do that. And so actually one of the, as I said, is not allowed to go into monasteries. There are no Baha'i monasteries.
Yeah, there are religions who do approve of sex within the marriage bond. The Taoism, for example, very much on that.
They're what?
Taoism from China.
I didn't understand what they do with sex.
There are religions who definitely approve of sex within the marriage bond.
Right.
And then there are others who say, well, you can't possibly be really religious if you don't give that up also. So
I see.
Baha'i comes down on the side of that's just part of life and that's the way you...
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, but you keep it channeled so that it doesn't harm.
Correctly.
Yeah. Do you have a concept of heaven and hell and reward and punishment, that sort of thing?
Yeah. I mean... I grew up Catholic, as I've mentioned before, and it's interesting, I say that only because I've gotten a certain idea, certain paradigm about heaven and hell and punishment and reward. It's been quite a challenge over the 25 years that I've been a Baha'i to really read the writings and understand specifically that aspect without sort of the Christian tinting of guilt. So the Baha'is do hold you responsible as an individual. You're responsible in front of God. And somewhere in the, I mean, Baha'u'llah says that bring yourself to account each day ere you're called to a reckoning by God. And so there is this concept of justice in front of God, and life is built on justice. And justice is a very important principle in the teachings. Yet, God is also merciful and forgiving. And heaven and hell, it's used in the writings. The best way I've heard it explained is that heaven is closeness to God and hell is remoteness from God. Hell is usually, actually in that sense, not considered as something that is very hot. Actually, rather the opposite, because Baha also means light and glory. So Baha'u'llah is really the glory. Baha'u'llah in Arabic means the glory of God. And light has a lot of symbolism. You find a lot of symbolism with light in the Baha'i writings. And so nearness to God is really being in the light, and remoteness from God was being in darkness. And light and heat, so it's probably nice and warm. That's how I would imagine it. Not necessarily like today, you know, air conditioning.
cozy or frost.
Cozy, yeah. The springtime, you know. So, well, if there's no more questions, we can call it an evening.
That's a good question.
Because I've talked a lot about the succession, and we had the interpreter, Abdul Baha, and then the guardian. And then when the guardian passed away, there was not an individual appointed anymore to lead the faith. Mm-hmm. But there is, I've talked about the administrative order. And so the Baha'i has a supreme governing body, which is the Universal House of Justice, which is elected members. And they are elected by members of national bodies, which are called national spiritual assemblies. And they are elected by representatives of local groups where believers get together to elect a representative to then elect them. So, and this group, the Universal House of Justice, in a sense is the authority nowadays that can mitigate or can judge or rule on questions of interpretation, and they can create laws or guidelines that are not specifically written down by Baha'u'llah. Now, in terms of learned, though, there is also a recognition of there is an established, what do we call it? There's an institution of the learned. Is that the counselors, right? The International Board of Counselors, which are people that have made themselves known in the faith because they have studied a lot. And as individuals, they're inspired to, or in some case, commissioned to help communities, to help believers with understanding of questions. But they don't have any actual authority. Well, again, there is a group of international counselors. There's a center for the teaching center, International Teaching Center, that's located in Haifa. So the seat of the Universal House of Justice is in Haifa. There's a teaching center in Haifa. Then there's another center for study of the text. So there's the World Administrative Center is in Haifa. And uniquely, actually, the World Spiritual Center is in Haifa too, which is not, most religions don't have the spiritual center and the administrative center in the same place. Like you would say, Rome is the administrative center for the Catholics, but Jerusalem or somewhere is the spiritual center where they go. So the International Board of Counselors is located in Haifa, but then they appoint counselors or appoint continental counselors, and then they have other people appointed underneath them. And these are people that are known, and Baha'is have written books. There are some great people there. But none of them are, I mean, so some of them will be revered to some degree because they're erudite, they have studied a lot and can learn a lot from them. But they're not held up in the light like the Guardian or Abdul Baha. They don't carry any authority. You've answered it?
Do you have churches, synagogues, temples, or is this mostly an inward faith?
No, we do have buildings. Actually, as a matter of fact, right now the Baha'is are building. So far, they have built a temple on each planet. Very advanced. These Baha'is are really advanced.
They are spread out, aren't they?
Yeah. So, like for instance, these are some pictures of them. So they have temples on each continent. This one here is the temple in India, which is really the last one that's been built, the Lotus Temple.
Yeah. Beautiful.
This one down here is like the one in America, is in Wilmette, which is this one here.
Illinois.
Yeah, Wilmette outside of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Now, these temples are all unique in the sense that they're all similar in the sense that they all have 9 doors.
Yeah.
nine entries. They're like a nine-pointed star, which is also the number 9 and the number 19 have a significance in the Baha'i writings. And these nine doors are really to welcome members of all the religions into this house of worship, which the house of worship, there are no statues, they're plain. They're places for worship and meditation. And in localities right now, in the future, when there are going to be lots more Baha'is, then there are going to be much more local houses of worship, and the local houses of worship will have, as Baha'u'llah talked about, they will have administrative institutions, they will have orphanages, they will have places for the elderly associated with them. But at the meantime, as the faith is in its growing stage, there are temples on each continent, and they're building one in South America right now in Chile, which is going to be quite spectacular too. And then some localities have centers. San Francisco has a Baha'i center, so they have a building where activities are held and people can gather. And then in many smaller communities like around here, people will gather in private homes. So it's all a matter of everybody come and join in, and we'll make it happen, because it's in growth, in development. Sure. You guys have to go.
Well, maybe one last question.
But they're allowed to go.
No. That sounds more like we have to go.
No, you don't have to go, but I know that. So you said you told me that you had to go, so I just want to make sure that don't feel obliged.
You might mention we are in the phone book, the local phone book, so they can just call up if they want any information.
The local phone book, and then I mean, and actually, I mean, here there are some great. Yeah, Chris.
I was going to say, if anybody's interested, you can give me your email, and I can email you some different. I can email people when there's different events, and if you'd like to be on a list or whatever, you can find out what's going on around here. If you're interested, you can come over here and I'll get your information.
Especially if you're willing to travel a little bit, I understand you in Rona Park or in Santa Rosa, not only in Sebastopol, right?
Yeah, we're having stuff in Sebastopol, and there's places like Rona Park, or there's just different places around here,
right,
and different kinds of events. So whether you're community-minded, or whether you want some sort of spiritual experience, or I don't know,
Or if you feel inspired to go to the Baha'i Center in San Francisco, I guess every month they have an open mic now. I've heard that. I have never been there, but it's fun, You can go to the open mic in San Francisco. But also, if you want to learn more, they have some great books here, which I haven't even read them all, but I know this little one here. I love a lot. It talks about Baha'u'llah and gives a great overview over the history. The Baha'is also have a great website. They have many websites, but Baha'i.org. It really gives you a lot of information. Yes.
Yeah, when
you want to say something about that, please.
Well, we have study circles, informal in people's homes and in most communities. So if you contact any of the communities through the phone book, you can ask if there's a study circle going on, or if you'd be interested, people would get back to you when it's time to start. But it's a sweet way to study with other people.
So if you call the local number in the Yellow Pages, who answers?
Well, Santa Rosa, I might answer.
Yeah, sure.
She might answer.
Well, I might not be there, so then the answer machine will take care.
But it goes into your home.
It does go into the home. Yeah, nobody here has a center.
The number one goes into an answer service, which I check.
And people who have never heard it, I mean, the Baha'is have a 1-800 number, right? Isn't it 1-800?
Yeah.
Unite.
Yeah.
And so people who just hear about it, they can call that, and then they will channel the investigation to a person in a more local area. So, and one of the things about these study circles that Trisha mentioned is what touches me about this is that it's one of the endeavors of the international Baha'i community right now to have study circles like this all across the planet, and a very systematized effort at making people acquainted with the faith, and so on.
Oh, the Word of God, really.
It's the Word of God, yes. Yeah.
So that you can get a better understanding.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank you on behalf of many rivers for